This is Jeremy Hobson, host of The Hobcast and former host of Here and Now and Marketplace Morning Report. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the third week of 2022, and this week, President Biden held his second full solo press conference since taking office a year ago. Taking questions for nearly 2 hours, he defended his administration's pandemic policies and efforts to tackle inflation. He said he expects Russia to invade Ukraine and talked about what the U.S. and NATO allies will do if that happens. And he took on Republicans who have refused to support almost all of his agenda, saying they haven't laid out any policies that they're in favor of. Let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. I'm your center. I'm joined by Jamel Bowie, columnist at The New York Times on the left. Hi, Jamel.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And on the right, Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, but let me start with this. There have been calls in recent days for a kind of a reset for the Biden presidency after some of his major initiatives have been foiled, mostly by Republicans, but also by some Democrats. Was this week the week we saw the reset, Jamel? And is there any chance of the reset making a big difference?
I suppose we could call this week a reset that, you know, the administration kind of turning a curve or a corner on voting rights and kind of putting that in their rear view, continuing to make it a rhetorical emphasis, but I don't think any expectation of passing a bill. There has been discussion of breaking up, been further discussion of breaking up the Build Back Better bill or amending it or redoing it even in order to get the votes to pass the Senate. So, you know, you can easily think of this as a reset. I think I want to push back a little just on the whole premise of the question. I often feel as if political journalism falls into like a bunch of, you know, a set of cliches about presidencies. And one of those cliches is this, you know, this idea that a tumultuous or divisive presidency in the first year has some sort of bearing on what's going to come afterwards. And I just don't think that's the case. To take an example of a presidency considered by many Americans to be successful, if you take Reagan in 81, if you read the coverage of Reagan's first year around this time in January 1982, it sounds almost identical to the coverage of Biden. If you read coverage of Clinton around the same at his 1 year time, it sounds about identical. I mean, if you read the coverage of these presidencies, of these presidents from comparable times in their presidencies, you'll see the same sort of arguments, the same sort of narratives, the same sort of cliches. And so I would just sort of, you know, I would caution against kind of overinterpreting anything we've seen over the last year. There's no doubt that Biden has had trouble, that his popularity, his job approval is flagging. But the most I think we can say about that is that it's hard to be president. It's difficult to be popular. And it's difficult to manage a big fractious coalition. How that, you know, what that means for the end of the year, much less 2 years from now, is to my mind a completely open question.
Well, and the other thing I think that was important about what he did this week in speaking to people and actually defending what's been going on is, you know, he laid out that, for example, with inflation, this is not something he can solve on his own. He talked about what the Federal Reserve could do about that. Obviously, COVID-19 is not something that he can solve on his own. In fact, there was a professor cited in the Washington Post this week who said the nation is basically ungovernable on COVID because there is a hostile court who just struck down his vaccine mandate for businesses, a hostile opposition. He obviously can't get voting rights or Build Back Better done on his own. So I take your point that it's not necessarily fair to say that there needs to be a reset in his presidency, although it is quite clear that there is a large amount of Americans who don't think things are going very well right now, which will matter when they have to go and vote. Megan, what are your thoughts?
Well, look, I think on the one hand that presidents get unfairly dinged for stuff that happens they don't have control over, right? Joe Biden was not out in South Africa inventing the Omicron variant. It just happened to him. And that's unfortunate, but I will say that it is pretty clear to me as someone who was following COVID policy extremely closely and what Trump was doing, what the administration was doing, a lot of their theory of how their first year was going to go rested on being able to take credit for stuff that Joe Biden didn't do, right? He comes in and he sets this absurdly low vaccination target that is actually below where we were. And so that he could take credit for meeting it. And I think that and there's a series of things like that where the idea is, look, we're going to jam a lot of shots in arms. COVID's going to go away. The economy is going to recover. Everyone's going to be so grateful to me for that and for not being Donald Trump, which is an achievement that I really respect and why I voted for him. But, you know, I will then use that political capital to pass these enormous new spending bills. And that didn't work out. I think the problem with the Biden administration is that there was no plan B. And you see this, they're kind of weirdly stuck on stuff that it was very clear that they couldn't do from almost the get-go, right? It's been clear for almost a year that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema were not going to go for this gigantic omnibus bill that is, as one person I talked to said, it's less of a program, a policy agenda, than it is just a list of the various constituencies in the Democratic Party. It was pretty clear that that was not going to happen. And they just kept pounding it. They just kept playing chicken with Joe Manchin and Sinema as if maybe if they really threatened to drive the car straight into the other side, something was going to happen. And when that didn't happen, they resorted to whining that they were not allowed to pass bills with only 48 out of 100 senators. And similarly with the Voting Rights Act, it was very clear that this was not going to happen. Also very clear, by the way, first of all, this does not have the impact on turnout the Democrats think. It does not actually change voting results as far as we can tell, except in the closest of elections, which is not relevant to what happened on January 6th. What is relevant to what happened on January 6th is the Electoral Count Act, which Democrats had, I think, a very good shot at reforming with Republican help, because Republican senators do not want Trump to be able to come back in 2024 if he runs again and loses again, as is a real possibility. They don't want him to be able to come back and say, you have to give me this. And so there were Republican senators who were willing to get on board and willing to reform this 19th century law that is quite unclear on areas where we really need it to be crystal clear, and which Trump was hoping to exploit in January of last year. We need to reform that. But by going out and saying that Republicans who don't vote for your extremely expansive bill are basically Bull Connor, you made that a lot less likely. And so he's been flailing in a way that, yes, we should recognize that he's getting a lot of flack for stuff that the president can't control. But on the other hand, he's getting flack for inflation, which is part of his policy. They drove a lot of money into American pockets that is now chasing too few goods. And if they had not done that, if you look at other similar industrialized countries, inflation is lower in France. It's lower in Germany. It's lower in Britain. We pushed a bunch of stimulus into an economy that couldn't really handle it, and inflation was the result. But also that he has not been flexible and adaptable when the plan A didn't work out. Instead, he just kind of keeps trying to do it again and again and again, as if maybe next time I'll get a different result. And I think that that is a really bad sign for his presidency. Yes, Reagan was troubled at this time in his presidency, but he also had a team that was capable of responding and adapting, rather than just hoping that if he did the same thing for the 18th time, a different result would come forward.
Jamel, a lot there, and we're going to get to a lot of it as we go on with the show. But let me just, because we will get to voting rights and Build Back Better in a little bit, let me ask you about that main point that, you know, Biden kept saying he was going to be able to do all these things and didn't adjust to the new reality. And you can pick it up where you'd like there on COVID or whatever. But what do you think about that? Did the Biden team not sort of change as the circumstances changed for what was possible?
I certainly think it's fair to say that on COVID, the Biden administration was caught flat-footed. I think with regards to the legislative agenda, from my view, the administration had sort of a muddled approach to how they were handling Joe Manchin in particular, but Kyrsten Sinema as well. And I think Megan is right to say that they were inflexible when it came to Manchin and when it came to sort of the actual structure of the bill, rather than sort of taking Manchin's offer, initial offers, and kind of building off of those, trying to accommodate Manchin's wishes in the structure of a bill that he clearly did not like. So I think that's a fair point. I just would like to once again to make a comparative point. The charge of inflexibility is kind of a cliche. Like if you read the coverage of Reagan in 82, you will see something very similar. Claims that this big, ambitious, ideologically motivated administration was not was too flat-footed to deal with economic circumstances, with the foreign policy circumstances, with things that come up. These kinds of claims about presidencies are kind of standard. And so for as much as criticisms are valid, I think I'm kind of channeling the CBS News correspondent John Dickerson here, who wrote a couple years ago about the presidency as a job, frankly, just too big really to do anymore, to do effectively anymore. And I think it's worth considering the kind of structural constraints and the structural position of the presidency and the way in which it is difficult for any person, no matter how skilled or able to really manage the presidency in a way that the public at large is going to find satisfactory, especially after 1 year in office.
Well, the other thing is, I think we are talking about the things that have gone wrong. I think it is still worth thinking about the fact that amid all the division in this country and all the things that can't be done, that more than 75% of Americans have gotten at least one dose of a brand new vaccine put into their bodies to try to keep this virus from continuing, which is pretty impressive, even given all the divisions that we have. Let's talk about Russia for a second, because this made a lot of news in this press conference that Biden gave this week. He said he expects that Russia will invade Ukraine. It has amassed 100,000 troops on the border of Ukraine, and it sounds like the U.S. and NATO would not fight back directly. However, as Jane Harman pointed out last week on this show, and as Biden said, the economic consequences could be really painful for Putin and Russia. They would include, as the New York Times pointed out, cutting off Russia's largest financial institutions from global transactions and imposing an embargo on American-made or American-designed technology needed for defense-related and consumer industries. Megan, what would you think of such a response? Because a lot of Republicans are quite angry about the fact that Biden, you know, said that this would be his response to a Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Look, I think that there is whatever party is out of office, especially with foreign policy, tends to like to talk as if the United States is the parent to the rest of the world and that we can just kind of go in and make things happen. You know, I think Vladimir Putin is pretty clearly going to invade Ukraine. I don't think, unless the United States is actually willing to go in there and take a series of belligerent steps that might drag us into an actual war with Russia, a nuclear armed power, our options are limited if Putin is really, really determined to do this. And I think that it's always convenient when you're criticizing your opposition to forget that, right? You saw this a lot with Trump on foreign policy sometimes, certainly with Bush on foreign policy, that, you know, oh, if Republicans had only done something different, a different outcome would have happened. No, actually, you know, these other powers are independent actors that make decisions for reasons that have not really that much to do with us.
You know, I really don't disagree and have much the same analysis of the situation. Unless critics of the administration here are prepared to say that the United States should commit itself to a armed conflict with Russia, then the actual range of options the United States has here is pretty constrained. And I do not think that American national interest is necessarily served by getting involved in a shooting war with another nuclear armed power, to put it lightly.
And I think it seems like there's general agreement across the political spectrum about that. I think the one thing I would add is if economic sanctions are the way forward, and severe economic sanctions are the way forward, Europe has got to be on board as well. And it's much more difficult for them because obviously they are reliant on Russia for energy. But if this is going to work and the U.S. is going to do it, the other NATO countries have got to do it as well. I will be back with Megan McArdle of The Washington Post and Jamelle Bouie of The New York Times to talk about the Biden agenda, again, voting rights and Build Back Better. We'll get deep into it. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
New year, new show. We're making changes to Left, Right, and Center, and you can weigh in. Leave a comment or ask us a question at kcrw.com/LRC.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
I'm Jeremy Hobson of The Hobcast. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left, Jamelle Bouie, columnist at The New York Times. And we are joined now by special guest John Avlon, political analyst at CNN and author of a new book about a president who knew something about governing during a crisis. It is called Lincoln and the Fight for Peace. John, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Good to join y'all.
Well, and what happens now with Biden's agenda? Republicans, as we've said, with the help from Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, have blocked the Build Back Better Act and the voting rights legislation. They didn't want to get rid of the filibuster. Is it dead? Is it going to move into smaller pieces and pass? What do you think, John?
Look, I think we need to move beyond the almost inevitable myopia of the moment, where I think people overestimate the day's news cycle. I think you just framed it correctly. A lot of key items of Biden's agenda, defending democracy through voting rights reform, election reform, build back better, were not failures of the Biden administration, the Democrats, as much as blockage by unanimous obstruction by Republicans, plus two Democrats who supported elements of those bills but didn't support fundamentally changing the filibuster to achieve them. I think that reflects the political reality that for all Biden's ambitions and the base's aspirations, he has a narrow control of the Senate as you could possibly get, 50-50, a narrow control of the House. And so the most ambitious initiatives are going to have a hard time to pass, especially when you don't have a kind of liberal Republican tradition that made it possible for presidents like Lyndon Johnson to cobble together coalitions. I do think, just taking a big step back, using a presidential historian hat for a second, if you just ask yourself, is America better off than it was 1 year ago on the day Biden's inaugurated? For all the inevitable strengths and weaknesses of Biden's first year, the answer is clearly yes. I mean, we were recovering from an insurrection attempt that we didn't know the worst of, despite having experienced January 6th. We've seen an enormous economic expansion, historic, you know, over 500,000 jobs a month, 6.4 million total, unemployment gone from 6.3 to 3.9. Yes, there's 7% inflation, which is significant. But on the economic front and on so many other fronts, like vaccinations, I mean, as you pointed out, I mean, over 75% of Americans now are fully vaccinated over the age of 18. That wasn't remotely the case in January of last year. So I do think, you know, you need to ding them for the stuff that's gone wrong. Inflation, while global, it's been partly a result of his policies. Afghanistan, where his numbers go down among independents after that botched withdrawal. But writ large, I think you got to give Biden more credit than I think he's getting today and to date for the state of the nation 1 year into his presidency.
You know, but again, I will say, on the issue of Afghanistan, just like with Russia, most Americans wanted to do exactly what he did, which was pull the troops out of Afghanistan. True. And there was really no easy way to do that. The fact that Americans and Afghans lost their lives in that ISIS attack at the airport was terrible and tragic. But the idea that we could have pulled all of those people out of Afghanistan so quickly without anything bad happening along the way seems unrealistic to me.
No, I think John is right that if we're comparing year over year, that for all the trouble, for all of the, you know, the delay when it comes to policymaking in Washington for everything, I think you can fairly say the United States is in a better place than it was a year ago in terms of its economic growth, in terms of at least, you know, the availability of vaccines. The pandemic, of course, is still ongoing, and many people have died as a result of it, but we have reached, as you noted, Jeremy, a high rate of vaccination at this point. It's not failure. It's just sort of disappointing, based on where I think the Biden administration expected to be at this point, and where I think Biden supporters expected to be. And as I feel like I've been hammering, I think that's just sort of inevitable, right? I think that if you do take the perspective of a presidential historian, you're going to be hard pressed to find a first year when anyone is necessarily feeling very optimistic about the course of a presidency. You know, an exception that proves the rule in this is is Jimmy Carter, who finished his first year with very high approval ratings. And people were very satisfied where things were going after Jimmy Carter's first year. And we all very much are aware of how the Carter presidency actually ended, which is to say that we can't, you know, so much of a presidency is driven by events, many of which we can't really anticipate ahead of time. And Americans are sort of perennially dissatisfied with a presidency until hindsight. Mm-hmm. And I think hindsight ends up smoothing over the rough patches. Presidents who we hold in high esteem collectively, Lincoln, to John's book, FDR, Reagan, Eisenhower, you know, the big ones that people hold in high esteem, in the moment, those presidencies look as fractious and divisive and prone to failure as any others do.
Megan, what do you think? Do you think that that in the first year of the Biden presidency, that things are better off now than they were a year ago?
I think that's actually a hard question. We have more people vaccinated, which is great. On the other hand, at least in my city of Washington, D.C., it doesn't feel that different from last year because everyone has sort of shut themselves away for Omicron. And so, in fact, you know, I'm still basically sitting in my house, not seeing people, not even because I'm not willing to, because I'm sort of on the vaxxed and relaxed spectrum, which is once I got vaccinated, I figured, okay, well, I've done what I need to, especially after I got a booster. But because other people don't want to, because there aren't events, there aren't policy dinners to go to, people aren't having parties, all of those things that were the normal piece of life, businesses are empty or often closing. And so in a lot of ways, it's not better. You know, some businesses are gone that weren't gone last year. We have less hope. I think people are also, after a year of this, more weary than they were a year ago. It's feeling less and less like, oh, well, we got through to the end and we won World War II, and more like, oh my God, now we're in the Cold War. So maybe this time next year, we'll look back and Joe Biden will be riding high on a wave of popularity as the economy rebounds. I think that's entirely possible. But I also do think that, for example, dealing with inflation is going to be really hard. Once you get inflation going, once it becomes what economists call unanchored from expectations, you often have to do quite nasty things to get it back under control. You have to sort of dampen down economic growth much more than you would have if you just always kept inflation right. steady state. We and he may be in worse shape next year, not better, as the Fed attempts to grapple with the inflation that has been touched off partly by the supply chain disruptions. But again, I'm going to say, partly because despite the fact that they were warned, the Biden administration spent a huge amount of its political capital putting stimulus into the economy that the economy was not prepared to absorb.
Right, which we talked about at length last week, yeah. and the idea that you basically would have to force a recession if inflation gets out of control, which is not going to be pleasant for anybody. Now, on the issue of the agenda at this point, John, keeping in mind that, you know, even when Obama had, 60 votes on his side in the U.S. Senate, he couldn't get a public option put into the Affordable Care Act, or even when President Trump had the majority in the House and the Senate, he couldn't repeal Obamacare. So, you know, a 50-50 Senate is not guaranteed to do much of anything. What happens now with the agenda, with the Biden agenda? Does anything, or does he just go on the road now and sell what he already did, infrastructure and the CARES Act?
Well, I think there's no reason why a president should simply accept that his agenda is dead and there's nothing he can do. It's the presidency. It's the bully pulpit. You go out and sell it and you keep working on a deal. And that may not look like what you first hoped. I think obviously Joe Manchin holds disproportionate power when it comes to what the remnants of the Build Back Better initiative could look like. But he's indicated support for some elements. And at this point, you should really try to figure out where you can triangulate his support and move it forward. I think so much of the conversation we've had, you know, in the historic sense, you know, the really triumphant first years come with super majorities. So whether it's FDR, LBJ, or even Jimmy Carter, they're Democratic super majorities. Or in the case of Eisenhower, there are Republicans, Democrats who Republicans can work with. That center doesn't exist. So a lot of the recalcitrance that exists is against the backdrop of a quarter of America still refusing to get vaccinated. That compounds the malaise. 70% of the Republican Party believing the Donald Trump's big lie about the election. And so these are very much live wire issues. I think that there's still a very good chance that the very least Electoral Count Act can get done. I think there's a good chance in bipartisan bills that some sort of social media algorithm reform can get done, which would defend our democracy. I think, unfortunately, things like Manchin's compromise bill, the Freedom to Vote Act, which includes voter ID, the Republicans aren't going to support it, even though in a rational political universe, a handful might. And so this is going to be a long slog, but I wouldn't count out some progress on some of these key issues, mm-hmm. including some version of Build Back Better, whatever might appeal to Joe Manchin on any given day.
Well, and Jamel, what about like climate change, universal pre-K? Are those things alive anymore?
Whether they're alive depends, again, on what Joe Manchin is willing to accept. I'm skeptical that they are. I'm skeptical that we'll see a universal pre-K program that makes any sense and that doesn't end up burdening people more than it helps. Maybe we'll get some, you know, maybe if there's this reconfigured bill, there will be some significant climate spending nowhere near what was initially envisioned, but something is better than nothing. But it's difficult to say, right? It depends on the administration's willingness to make this a priority, and you know Joe Manchin's willingness to want to negotiate and want to come to a deal and want to pass something. I think the extent to which whether or not Senator Manchin actually wants to pass something, I think remains an open question. If he does, then there is probably a path. If he really doesn't, if he's actually reluctant to pull the trigger on additional spending, then I think that just might be the ball game.
Megan, what do you think? And would it be a problem for you if none of these other items on the Biden agenda got passed?
Well, that's not a problem for me. I voted for Biden because he wasn't Donald Trump. So I'm not a big supporter of the Democrats' more expensive expansive, but I think expensive is in fact the right way to look at it. You know, I think we haven't figured out how to pay for the entitlements we have. I don't think we should be passing massive new programs. And I think that there has been, you know, for a long time, right, the right had this incredibly irresponsible supply side economics view, which is still quite common on the right, sadly. Where you can just cut taxes and it doesn't matter, it pays for itself. And the left has developed its own kind of weird economic mythology about how you can spend any amount of money and it doesn't matter and it just pays for itself. Actually the idea is that the Fed can then pay for it through this incredibly arcane set of calculations I will not go into. But either way, right, it was a kind of self-delusion to enable you to do what you want and not think about the consequences. And I think that in part that is part of what animated the early stimulus. Was that, you know, Biden and his staffers had kind of started to believe that it didn't matter what you did. So for me, no, I don't actually, I'm not bothered if they can't do it. But I think that politically for Biden, if I were on his staff, I would tell him to go to Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and just sit them down in the room and say, okay, what would you like that I can call a bill? And mm-hmm. I would push whatever it was that they came out with. And I would tell the rest of the caucus that if they don't like it, that's too bad because this is all you're getting. And I don't know. You know, I think they've been kind of groping towards that. But the problem with that strategy is that the progressives really, really don't want it. You know, even leaving aside, they have a sincere belief that if you do that, in the same way that they're mad that they allowed the Biden administration to separate the infrastructure bill that was passed earlier this year with Republican support from the bigger package, because that made it harder to pass the bigger package, right? You had more kind of poison pills in there and fewer goodies that everyone agreed on. They don't want to do something smaller because they feel like that means the bigger thing that they really want will never happen.
John Edlin?
Yeah. So let me be the tiebreaker here as a card-carrying centrist who literally wrote a book on centrists and American politics. I think traditionally, centrists have been the ones most open to making a deal. I think Jamel makes a really important point in that, contrary to a lot of the political posturing we typically see where extremes are the most inflexible, the most intractable, the least likely to compromise, we have not seen that this time around. The progressives have been very accommodating, and it's actually been particularly Senators Sinema and Manchin who've been the most intractable. Manchin and Sinema have multiple meetings at the White House. Manchin has said constantly he thought he would be able to get there.
Right.
You know, Megan makes an important point that, you know, what really Democrats need are more red state and rural Democrats. They have a margin. It's far from clear Manchin, by the way, wouldn't get reelected in West Virginia or even wants to be elected, reelected. I mean, he's not a spring chicken. Then nobody is in Washington, it seems, these days. But I do think the progressives in this case have been more flexible than the center. That's a departure from recent politics. But Democrats also need to recognize the reality that this is a function of their margins, and they need more red state and rural Democrats, maybe in the model of John Tester rather than Joe Manchin, but if they're going to have any kind of governing margin for their flexibility. Well, so I think we've got a reversal of the typical dynamics we see in politics in recent months.
They've also got to go out and make their case. I just think that, you know, you look at all of the people who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump, or voted for Bernie Sanders and then voted for Trump. People are, yes, people have hardened views, but they are also willing to be convinced if you actually go out and make the case for the things that you want to do.
There's a catch-22, actually, because a lot of those voters you just discussed are people who feel like the Democratic Party and Washington elites haven't delivered for them. Working class folks or middle class folks who've been squeezed for decades. And a lot of what Biden's trying to pass would alleviate some of their economic stress. Mm-hmm. So that's an older school view that I think is important to square in the circle.
That is John Avalon, CNN political analyst and author of Lincoln and the Fight for Peace. John, thank you so much for joining us.
My great pleasure, guys.
And we will be back in a moment with Jamel Bowie, columnist of The New York Times, and Megan McArdle, columnist of The Washington Post, with the question, what are Republicans for? You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
This is Left, Right, and Center. We're changing things up, but always keeping it civilized yet provocative. Let us know what you want to hear or who you want to hear from. You can ask a question or leave a comment at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jeremy Hobson of The Hobcast, former host of Here and Now and Marketplace Morning Report. On the right, Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Jamel Bowie, columnist at The New York Times. And let's talk about the Republicans. Here is what President Biden said in his news conference this week.
I did not anticipate that there'd be such a stalwart effort to make sure that the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Think about this. What are Republicans for? What are they for? Name me one thing they're for.
Megan McArdle, what are Republicans for right now?
Well, look, I think it's ridiculous to argue that the only thing that's stopping Joe Biden is Republican obstruction, given that the obstruction that's worrying him comes from his own caucus. I will also point out that they did pass a pretty big infrastructure bill. They passed a pretty major stimulus bill. Republicans have not yet. I think that talking about Republican obstruction is a really accurate way to talk about the last 4 years of the Obama term. But I don't actually think, I think it's a kind of vestigial reflex that the Democrats just always blame Republican obstruction, even when that's not what's going on. But I will say this, that I think that he is nonetheless highlighting a real problem for Republicans. What are they for? I think that that's something they're still struggling to hammer out. You know, the arrival of Trump has collapsed the party's old understanding of itself. I think that understanding had become pretty hollow anyway for a bunch of reasons that I've written about a lot of times. But it really just imploded with Trump and nothing has come to replace it. And I think you really saw this when Trump was trying to replace Obamacare. They're like the dog that caught the ambulance. They get in and Trump is trying to do this. And it's clear that no one has thought about what a replacement would look like. And there's a report that, you know, they had a retreat and a congressman actually stood up and said, wait a minute, you mean we just kept voting and we didn't have a plan? No, they didn't have a plan because they don't really care about healthcare. They cared about saying no. And you see this repeated over and over with a ton of issues. Is the Republican Party is just defining itself way too much. First of all, in terms of this dead vestigial Reaganism, where they just keep wanting to cut taxes, even though taxes are already pretty low. But more importantly, you know, Reagan is passing tax cuts at a time when tax brackets are not indexed for inflation. So people keep, you know, they're purchasing power isn't going up, but their nominal income is going up and they're getting driven into higher and higher tax brackets. And so, first of all, they're paying meaningful taxes, even at lower income levels. And also they're really mad about it because they notice. And those things aren't true. We index our tax brackets. We have cut at the bottom so that the bottom three quintiles pay virtually no federal income tax. They pay other taxes, state and local taxes, Social Security, but they don't pay the federal income tax. And so cutting taxes doesn't really help them. And so Republicans have this issue that just isn't an issue for most voters. And it's the one thing that they can agree on. You notice that's the one thing Trump really did, right, was tax cuts. You know, there are some signs that the conservative movement is trying to fill that gap. I went to the National Conservatism Conference this year in Orlando, and it was really interesting because not because I agree with a lot of what was going on, but because it was intellectually, clearly there was a lot happening as people were trying to figure out what do we have in common? What sorts of coalitions could we build? What agenda could we coalesce around? But I will say this, nonetheless, I went to two panels on what might be called woke capitalism. And one of them was about people complaining about woke capitalism. And the other one was about rethinking conservative ideas about labor markets. And guess which one was better attended? You know, the complaining and the yelling by a long shot. And I think that is a core problem for Republicans right now, which is that they love screaming about critical race theory and Democrats and all the rest of it. But they are a lot less good at putting forward a positive agenda of what is the vision, my vision for the country, and what am I going to bring to voters that Democrats will not?
Jamel, I imagine you agree with a lot of that.
I do. It is difficult to say on the level of policy what the Republican Party is for these days. Now, on the level of sort of cultural politics, I think that's very straightforward. I think that former President Trump, and those who seek to succeed him have actually pretty successfully crafted an image for the Republican Party as the Republican Party that stands for a kind of, you know, providing patriarch, a party that will facilitate your own attempt to accumulate capital to maybe open a small business, that will not stand in your way if you want to become a kind of like small holding capitalist and ride that train to prosperity. I think Trump was very successful in taking that image, taking that idea and using it to appeal to a broad cross-section of Americans. Not enough to win re-election, but enough really to, I think, reorient the Republican Party around that image. But in terms of a policy, I think it's right to say that there's not really anything there. And that might just be a function of the fact that there are some real, you know, internal contradictions when it comes to the kind of the policy instincts of, I think, many Republican conservatives and the kind of electorate they're chasing, right? So if you are trying to chase a more working class electorate, an electorate of people who don't necessarily own a business or don't necessarily own capital, but would like to have it, that's going to, I think if you want to appeal to their economic interests, you're going to have to do things that, you know, increase the power of labor, that improve the power of labor, that maybe even allows labor to organize a bit more for itself. But then that runs square into the desires of, you know, much of the Republican, donor base at the very least, but I think a good chunk of the social base of the Republican Party as well. Increasing the power of labor undermines some of the coalition partners, whether that is, again, owners of, you know, moderate to large businesses, owners of financial capital, and it undermines, you know, it undermines elements of the social conservative coalition. Strengthening economic power is maybe another way of saying increasing economic independence, and economic independence does actually erode the influence of those who would like sort of a hierarchical grip on their communities. So there are these contradictions that are just tough to square. That's not really the right word, but I can't think of it. And it's not clear to me at this point that there's anyone, any figure within the Republican Party who is able to do that necessarily. Or if they're able to do that, it's very superficial. And when it comes to actually make policy, they may not be able to create some sort of coherent vision.
One of the reasons we don't hear a coherent vision from Republicans is they are still so, politicians anyway, is that they are still so afraid of Donald Trump and what he's going to think about what they want to do. And many of them had to throw out so many of their principles when he was president to begin with. They had talked about fiscal responsibility and then ran up the national debt hugely even before the pandemic. On the issue of free trade, a lot of them were in favor of free trade, and then they were totally fine with the tariffs that he put on not just China, but on our allies as well. You know, talked a good game about religious freedom, and then there was the Muslim ban. So there were a lot of principles that had to be thrown out. The one thing I think that actually you could say right now that is a Republican principle, and I just drove across the country and saw how different places are handling the pandemic. One thing that you could say is Republican politicians in general are favoring freedom over regulation in terms of COVID restrictions. And especially you see that in a place like Florida with Ron DeSantis, who is now even criticizing President Trump's shutdown early in the pandemic and saying that he wouldn't have done that. And this is a state where there have basically been no restrictions for over a year when it comes to COVID-19. So let me just finally ask just briefly about that sort of dynamic in the Republican Party. Megan, what do you think of the sort of Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump? They're 1 and 2, Trump being on top, DeSantis number 2 in the polls at this point, looking forward to 2024. But DeSantis is one who has not said he won't run if Trump is running.
Look, I will support anyone who is not Donald Trump and is some sort of a land-based mammal, preferably a biped. And that is also how I feel about the Republican nomination. I have my quarrels with Ron DeSantis, but I would certainly prefer him to Donald Trump. So I hope that he wins. I hope that he does run. If he does not, I hope that someone else does and actually takes on Donald Trump. I would happily support that person in the primary and might well vote for them in the general. But I think it is going to be tough. I think that you know,
beating Trump would be tough, you're saying.
Well, yeah, I have two ideas about this. One is that I'm not actually sure that Donald Trump is as powerful as Republicans think he is. You know, it's telling that he recently went on tour with Bill O'Reilly, and my understanding is not even selling out the stadiums, and not huge stadiums. He has not succeeded in knocking off any of the candidates he's targeted for retribution. The only people, as far as I can tell, he's actually managed to cost re-election are the Georgia senators who went along with his outrageous Stop the Steal allegations. And so I think actually he's probably more beatable than people think he is, but it's certainly going to be, I think a tyrant, you know, a kind of Mothra versus Godzilla knockdown, drag out fight if indeed someone does try to take him on, because he is going to mobilize all of the tactics of, you know, poison personality, getting his base riled up and all the rest of it. He's going to throw everything at that person. And if they go, I certainly hope they are ready, and I will be rooting for them every step of the way.
Jamel, what do you think? What do you see going forward? Do you think Trump has enough control over the Republican Party to be the nominee again? Or do you think he would face a real test from someone like Ron DeSantis?
I think that Trump is in a position where he has a credible threat of exit here, right? if it, he could, I think Trump would credibly say, if you run against me, I will do everything I can to derail the party's ability to win the next presidential election. I think that was his threat in 2016. I think that remains his threat. And again, I think it's a very credible one. That said, I do think he can be beaten in a Republican primary. It would just depend on the candidate in question and some sizable, you know, fraction of Republican elites being willing to take the risk that Donald Trump will pull a Samson and try to take the whole party down with them. They have to be willing to accept those consequences to knock him out. And that's sort of, that is kind of the big question. I have no doubt that, for example, Ron DeSantis is ambitious enough and is aggressive enough politically to want to try to take down Trump in a Republican primary.
Well, we have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Megan McArdle, it's your soapbox.
Democrats are wrong to compare Republicans who won't support the voting rights bill to Bull Connor. It is a fairly outrageous slander, but they're not wrong to worry about what Republicans are doing with elections. The problem, though, is not that the Republicans are going to suppress voters trying to go to the polls. The problem is that they're going to try to trigger a constitutional crisis if Trump runs again and loses again. And in order to prepare for that, what Republicans need to do is make it clear to the base right now that Stop the Steal didn't happen, and that the election was actually, by and large, conducted about as honestly and effectively as you could hope, either in a pandemic or out of it. Instead, they have cravenly chosen to capitulate to Trump's sore loserish insistence that he actually won the election. They have gotten worse about this over time. And in doing so, they are affirming to the base that Trump's lies are true. And they're building up expectations that if Trump runs again and loses again, that they'll do something about it the next time. This is the real assault on our democracy, and it has to stop. But only Republicans can do it.
Jamel Bowie, what's your rant?
Last year, Virginia Republicans swept the statewide races. They won all three. They won those races in an environment of very liberal voting laws, with you know, plenty of early voting, plenty of absentee voting, everything I think liberals could want. And yet, Republicans in Virginia are still considering restrictions on voting, on reducing the amount of early voting, on implementing stricter voter ID requirements that may not directly cause people to not go to the polls in the next cycle, but do erect burdens where there weren't burdens before and do require more energy to overcome. The point is that I think Republican efforts to restrict voting in this way are significant. I think they reflect a suspicion of mass voting and a suspicion of basic tenets of political equality. And that even if these schemes, whether they end up coming to fruition in Virginia, whether they're ones like have been attempted in Georgia or Texas or Alabama, regardless of whether they are as effective as Republicans hope them to be, I think attempts to put burdens on the right to vote are wrong on just a moral level, regardless of who benefits in an election. And I personally am somewhat frustrated with efforts to dismiss them by saying that they're not statistically significant. It's much less an issue of significance for turnout percentages and much more a significance for the basic idea that voting is a fundamental right that shouldn't be curtailed for any reason.
For my rant, for the last couple of years, we have been following the science on COVID-19, and I think it's time we follow the science when it comes to blood donations. As you may know, there's a national blood shortage, but gay and bisexual men who want to donate blood are still required to abstain from sex for 3 months before donating blood because of fears about HIV/AIDS, even though all donated blood is screened for all kinds of things, including HIV. Those restrictions for men who have sex with men came about in the 1980s and are not based on science. They are based on stigma. They also apply, by the way, to donations of convalescent plasma for COVID-19 research. The LGBTQ advocacy group GLAAD estimates that if the ban were lifted, an additional 360,000 men would likely donate blood, which could help save the lives of over a million people. The Biden administration says it agrees that the policy is painful, but that there are no new decisions to announce at the moment, pending the results of a study. It is time to stop delaying and stop discriminating. An administration that talks a good game about diversity, equity, and inclusion should apply that to everyone, including gay and bisexual men. That is all the time we have today. Thanks to Megan McArdle, Jamel Bowie, and John Avlon. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine-Million. Production assistance by Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Jeremy Hobson. I want to thank KCRW for having me. Thanks for joining us. And tune in next week with David Green as your next guest host for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.